Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello everybody, welcome to this latest episode. It's been a few weeks, I think, since we were last here. I think, was it Endgame last time? I think it was Endgame. So we are back out into the, well, not really the wastelands so much as off into the ocean. But we'll get to that momentarily. I am Adrian Smith, and with me as ever is my co-host from across the ocean, Rod Barnett.
Hello, everyone. I am not a descendant of Atlantis, I am pretty sure.
I've got so many questions.
This movie is essentially a raft of questions surrounded by an ocean of what in the hell are we doing here?
Yes, it is. So, brief catch up, I guess. You've had several podcast episodes out since last time we did this. Anything you want to mention from the Bloody Pit or the Neshi cast?
I've been very pleased with the last three episodes. I just our episode on the Mad Ghoul from 1943 just went up, very happy with that because that's a film that I don't think gets nearly enough attention, and it's much more adult in its approach and in the way it handles things than a lot of the universal horror films of the 1940s that it's surrounded by. So it's really fascinating to examine that and to really kind of wallow in the joys of watching George Zucco actually have just some really juicy dialogue that isn't an embarrassment to speak. He's great in anything, but he really gets to some good stuff to do in the Mad Ghoul. And the episode before that, was very pleased with how everyone's taken to that one, where Mark Clark and I, the author, talked about 8 giant bug movies from the 1950s. That's been a very popular episode, and I can see why. Mm-hmm. I mean, you start talking about those movies. Yeah, there were 8. That's just it. I always, I've talked about before how it just seems like there was a big blob of giant bug movies in the 1950s. And then when you actually get down to it, there were really only 8. And I always thought, you know, if I had to like throw out a ballpark figure, I would have guessed, 15, maybe 16. But no. What you're doing is kind of conflating like the giant lizard movies and all the other movies like that. It's like, if you're just saying bug, it's a different thing entirely. So,
fair enough.
Yeah.
And of course, those bugs generally were mutated through some kind of nuclear blast
out there
in the desert. Mm-hmm. Which kind of brings us nicely round to what we're doing in this season. And, the apocalypse and nuclear destruction has never seemed quite so fun as it did in the 1980s in Italy. But this film, so this episode, we are on to the, well, it depends what you want to call it, the Atlantic Interceptors, you could call it. You can call it Raiders of Atlantis. The Italian title is I Predatori di Atlantide, or you know, the Predators of Atlantis, I guess. And
well, my alternate title in English is Help Me, I'm So Confused.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, I was going to say the one that you can't call it is Coherent.
This is true.
So this is a entry into the canon from Ruggero Deodato, who I think we're all big fans of.
Oh, and yeah.
Is this it? I can't remember. We've done him before, haven't we? Or have we?
We've talked about him. Have we actually covered any of his movies?
I'm not sure. You and I, like the first time I ever appeared on your podcast was to talk about Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah.
And since then, I've joined you at least one more time where we talked about Hercules, Prisoner of War.
Yeah, which he had a hand in.
Which he basically directed.
Yeah. But we did talk about Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man.
We mentioned it, but we didn't do an episode.
Yeah, we didn't do an episode on it. And
But I mean, I do love that movie. But yeah, Ruggero Deodato is such a lovely guy. And obviously, we just lost him last year.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interview on the Blu-ray of this release by Severin that he did, which I don't know if it's one of the last, but it must be one of the last interviews he did, which is a shame. Yeah, I've mentioned this story before, but I interviewed him about 12 years ago now, probably. And it was around the time when the latest edition of his book was being republished by Fab Press, called Cannibal Holocaust and the Savage Cinema of Ruggero Deodato. And I did a little mini episode a couple of months ago. Actually, when he died. I think it was earlier this year, wasn't it? Like January or February.
It was last year. It was in 2022.
Was it? Okay. Well, anyway, they just did a new edition of the book again. It seems like every 10 years there's another version of this book. So I met him when it was the second edition. And he's just a lovely guy.
The last thing you would probably expect, considering the tone and content of most of his films. I mean, you know, everything from Cannibal Holocaust to House on the Edge of the Park to Cut and Run to Body Count. I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So he'd just done, it's what makes this film kind of an interesting movie, even if it, as a film, it doesn't make any sense. But it's quite interesting because from where it sits in his career, because he'd just done Cannibal Holocaust. And by the time Cannibal Holocaust came out and, you know, all the kind of international furore kicked off, he'd already shot House on the Edge of the Park. So that was in the bag. He'd done those two films quite close together. But then once Cannibal Holocaust had gone public and he'd gone to court and it had been banned and, you know, all of that stuff, he pretty much couldn't get any more work. He was struggling to get any more gigs, I think, because people just associated him now with such an extreme level of filmmaking that nobody would hire him, basically. So my understanding is, I watched the interview with him talk a little bit about this. He was invited by a producer to go to the Philippines to meet Imelda Marcos.
Yeah. I guess.
Because she had built, I think she wanted to turn the Philippines into a big filmmaking center. Which, I mean, let's not forget, tons of movies were shot in the Philippines in the 70s, particularly by Roger Corman and the like. And she built this big studio facility and wanted to invite people to come and use it. And so he was invited to go, and I think he may have been one of the first. From the way he talks about it in the interview, it was like he was the first actual director to turn up there. Because he said they had loads of great facilities whilst at the same time having loads of stuff missing. Like they didn't have tracking or dollies.
Yeah, it's like there were things that they were unaware of that were pieces and parts. You know?
Yeah, that they needed. They had a stunt school, and all these guys were great at doing what they did. And they had makeup people sitting around, but they didn't have any actors. And it was just a weird situation. And he got shown loads of great locations. And eventually, after much to-ing and fro-ing, he agreed to come and make a film there. But they never really had a proper script. That's my understanding.
And it shows. My God, does it show.
This is a film that was improvised for the most part. And yeah, but maybe we should take a step back before we get into whatever the hell is going on. So technically, there is a script. And it was written by, according to credits, Tito Capri and Vincenzo Menino. Although Deodato says he came up with the basic story and worked with them on that. Are there any other names associated with this film that you want to mention or look at before we try and
pick
the story? I mean, Tito Carpi did Tentacles, for example. And he was involved in the Bronx Warriors trilogy and a bunch of stuff like that. He did Codename Wild Geese. So he was a fairly accomplished writer.
Yeah, Vincenzo Menino, his name's attached to Devilfish and even all the way back to Argo, the Fantastic Superman.
Hey.
And apparently worked with Fulci on as a writer on the New York Ripper.
Oh, right.
But, you know, yeah, and he had a hand in Violent Rome and several other films of note in the 70s. But like I say, I mean, it really feels like this one got away from
it. Where were
they? Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, don't get me wrong. You look at his list of credits and you realize, okay, he was obviously a guy who would try his hand at almost anything. I mean, when you're writing things, you know, comedies like I'm for the Hippopotamus and, you know, right next to Special Cop in Action and Violent Naples, it's like, okay, so, you know, you're definitely game for trying anything. Yeah. But the fact that there's an unfinished feeling to this film has to come down to, see, my initial thought was maybe they lost the script.
Yeah.
And we're just having to improvise and throw it all together later in the editing room. But the knowledge that there really wasn't a finished screenplay or a screenplay that they had either, you know, all agreed was what we're going to do kind of shows itself pretty effectively.
Yeah. I mean, they basically just had a load of ideas for set pieces and things that they could shoot in the Philippines. And then I think they got back to Italy and tried to piece it together, found a load of gaps. So shot some more stuff in Italy in studios, and I think some of the stuff on the beach is just down in Italy. And then, try to make something of it. And So why are we talking about it in relation? Because it's not a post-apocalypse. It is set in the future, though. It's set in the futuristic year of 1994.
I know, 11 years in the future from when the film was made. And it's strange that all of the cars seem to have tags that say 1983. It's very strange.
Yeah. And they, so we begin, it's a little bit James Bond style in that we begin in the middle of a story that's just unfolding, a kind of big action sequence. So our star, we've had him on the podcast before. This time he doesn't have his big truck. It's Christopher Connolly.
And there's an actor right there. Let's take note of the fact that Christopher Connolly was almost always a kind of supporting character. Mm. He was a guest star. He's not someone who really rarely, shall we say, was the lead in a film. But he was also a face that by the time this movie got made, he's fairly familiar.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he was before he struck out into doing the Italian stuff of this type, you know, where he ends up doing, you know, Strike Commando and Django Strikes Again with Franco Nero in the late 80s. Before that, I mean, he was doing, you know, lots of television guest stars. I mean, the year he made this, or the year this came out anyway, he was in The Fall Guy, Matt Houston, Fantasy Island, Bring Him Back Alive. So he's doing a lot of television while also doing things like The Bronx Warriors, as you were talking about before. But he's, you know, I think for a lot of us, I mean, you have to take note of him because he was in the well-received and well-done television miniseries over here for The Martian Chronicles.
Oh, yeah.
And he was in Benji, which was a major hit over here in 1974.
Is that about
and
a dog?
He was. Oh, definitely, definitely. Oh, yeah, that okay. was. I have fond memories of seeing that movie in the theater when I was six, and it being, you know, it being one of those things where you're like, ah, wow,
yeah,
this is really cool, and I'm six, that. so I think it's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, no, wait a minute. I would have been like seven or eight. At any rate. It's one of those things where he's just one of those guys who for a long period of time seemed like just one of those faces that's going to pop up all the time, but always in supporting roles. Yeah. You know, you go back into the 60s and you'd spot him on, you know, The Fugitive and My Three Sons and Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea and just everything under the sun. You know, it's all, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But putting him in the lead role here, he handles the lead role just fine.
Yeah.
He's got the kind of semi-masculine, you know, the semi too masculine, craggy, possibly too craggy a face that kind of spells out serious, possible hard man with a heart of gold. And that's what's required.
At least 20 years older than the romantic lead.
Oh, I know. we should talk about her because. Yeah.
So he's some kind of mercenary, appears. He's involved in kidnapping somebody from this beautiful mansion, and his partner in this endeavor is a guy called Wash. But every time he calls him Wash, he says, "My name's not Wash; it's Muhammad," because he's evidently
recently converted. Yeah.
But they only keep that up for about the first 15 minutes of the film, and then everyone just keeps calling him Wash, and it's the Muhammad thing is never mentioned again, which again is another kind of gap in that you wonder at what point in the script they thought that was a good idea or didn't or something. But anyway, so
yes.
And he's played by Tony King, who has also he's an American actor, been in a bunch of stuff, including other Italian films.
And, oh yeah, well, I mean, he worked with Antonio Margheriti in Cannibal Apocalypse and The Last Hunter. Mm-hmm. But also in big movies with like Richard Pryor and Burt Reynolds. He was in Sharky's Machine and things like that.
And so, goes back to Shaft. He's in that, isn't he? Shaft.
Yeah. I think that was his first screen role. But at the same time, you get to the point where you're like, oh, okay, so this is a guy who has been around the block a few times, knows what he's doing, but Not long after this, the roles did seem to kind of dry up for him.
Mm.
I'm not sure what was going on, but past about this movie, he's not really doing much work again until the early 90s, and then it gets really spotty. And it appears that he may still be alive, but I'm not sure that anybody's ever tried to find out what's going on with him.
Yeah, which is a shame. I'd be interested to do an interview with him of some sort.
Definitely would.
But I was wondering whether, because he played a character in a Margheriti film just a couple of years earlier than this, one of his Vietnam films. Which one was it?
The Last Hunter.
Tiger Joe.
He was in Tiger Joe.
He's in Tiger Joe, where he also plays a character called Washington. Well,
his character in The Last Hunter was named George Washington.
Oh, there. So maybe these are all connected. It's like a shared universe. And the Atlantis Interceptors is about what he did when he got home.
Maybe so. Yeah. We Atlantis Interceptors gives us the vision into the 1994 future of this particular character.
This is where Vietnam vets end up as mercenaries. So they kidnap somebody and they take him away and they get paid a lot of money to do this. And then they decide they're going to go off in a on a yacht and just get out of town and have a lovely holiday together. So they're off,
as you do.
Yeah. So they're just off into the ocean. Meanwhile, we cut to a big oil platform in the middle of the ocean, which apparently belonged to Deodato's brother-in-law. Deodato is married into some big rich oil family in Italy.
Really?
Yeah. So he got he got access to this oil platform because of his brother-in-law. And out on this oil platform is George Hilton, mm-hmm. playing Professor Saunders. And George Hilton, now, have we had him on the podcast before? I think we probably have. I'm starting to lose track now.
Oh, we've definitely he's a talked legend. About yeah. George Hilton we've before. Done,
sure,
yeah,
he is, yeah. And he is involved in some top secret stuff out there. But he's waiting for this helicopter to arrive, and the helicopter lands, and out jumps Ivan Razumov. It's like kind of Italian cult cinema bingo. they're all popping up.
Yeah, yeah.
And he plays the helicopter pilot, Bill, and he's brought with him Dr. Kathy Rollins, played by Gioia Scola, who mm-hmm. is an expert in pre-Mayan languages, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, it's vaguish enough that you know it's going to be important.
Yeah, and she's just annoyed because she doesn't know why she's there. She feels like she's been kidnapped. But did you want to mention anything about her before? She's not an actress I was familiar with.
Well, I didn't think I was very familiar with her either. I knew I had seen her in this film, but it turns out that she has a role in Fulci's Conquest from the year before.
Oh.
And also in...
I know how much you like that one.
I am a fan. I'm not going to pretend otherwise. not for the reasons that should probably be... Yeah, probably. I should probably clamp down on that. But also, I recently saw her when I finally watched the sort of sequel to Nothing Underneath from 1988 called Too Beautiful to Die. She's in that as well.
Uh-huh.
She didn't have a very long... career from roughly the mid 70s in film, at least from roughly the mid 70s to roughly the mid 90s. Right. So maybe I'm wrong to say that. It's 20 years is probably a pretty good run, especially for someone who was apparently she was an actress who got her start in photo novels in Italy, and then she won the Miss Teenager Beauty Contest at some point.
Haven't we all?
Oh, I can relate. Yeah. And then, so she started, that's how she got into films. But I find it weird that she was involved in the mid 90s. She was indicted as part of a drug trafficking scheme between Naples and Rome. And there were a lot of other public figures, such as Berlusconi, involved. She was arrested for 5 months, two of which were under house arrest. And in 1996, she was indicted along with other defendants.
Wow.
And it took years for this to wind its way through the court. And she was eventually acquitted in January of 2007 because there was just not enough evidence to tie her into any of this.
Right.
But the experience she used to write the screenplay for a film that came out in 2001. It's very, what can you say other than, wow. There are different ways to keep your hands in the entertainment business. And, a possibly wrong conviction or indictment, I should say.
Yeah.
Indictment, she was never convicted, for drug trafficking. Yeah, why not use that? That's a good idea. Run with it.
Wow. Yeah, okay. Well, there we go. So
told you I wanted to talk about it.
Yeah, yeah, that's good research. So I'm going to cut now to the plot summary, because this is kind of where the plot summary starts in the Deodato book, Cannibal Holocaust. So this is where we find out what's going on this oil platform. So it says, when a secret Atlantic mission to refloat a stricken nuclear submarine is inexplicably disrupted by blackening skies and towering waves, the domed island of Atlantis rises from beneath the waves, and a motorcycle gang called the Interceptors lays waste to an American coastal town.
Now,
there's a couple of
let's talk about this. I mean, let's really think about this for a second. First of all, let's just be honest and say the miniatures in this film leave a good deal to be desired.
They're really bad. It's like in the other book that we've been using, After the World Ends, it talks about how it looks like they've just been shot in a bathtub.
Yeah.
They're right.
I'm not arguing with that. That's a fair statement.
This domed city rises out of the sea, and it just looks terrible. And there's a bit at the end, I mean, it's not giving too much away to say that we see it sink again. And the dome closes as the water is sinking, and you can see that it hasn't closed properly.
No, it hasn't closed all the way. There's like, seal.
Well, they're all dead.
Yep.
The water's just pouring in. Oh, dear. It's really bad. So we've got we've got all our characters here. Dr. Kathy, we've got Bill, the pilot, Professor Saunders. Oh, we've also got Mikhail Soavi, who's playing radar operator. He was there because he was also the assistant director. And so they're all on board, and things are starting to go wrong as this submarine is rising, and then the waters all go mad. But it doesn't really make any sense. And then obviously we've meanwhile got our guys on the yacht, Mohammed and Mike, and they're caught in the storm as well. And so the next morning they pick up some survivors, which is Bill, Professor Saunders, Dr. Kathy Rollins, Michaela Soavi, and I think that might be it. So they're the only sort of survivors of this, because the oil rig has sunk as well. So
talking about the miniatures, they didn't even attempt to match the look of the miniature rig that gets swamped by the waves to the actual one. I mean, it's comic. It's nearly a joke. It's like, oh, is this some other rig? Are we supposed to be? But no, it's just bad.
It's like they didn't have any reference photos for
when
they built it or something.
They must not have.
They just got a generic oil rig picture and made it out. So we've already had our first glimpse by this point of the interceptors, because it's basically a gang of Mad Max extras on choppers and three-wheel bikes and tricked-out cars with spikes on the wheels, and they've got all the mohawks and the makeup, and they're led by a guy called Crystal Skull, because he's wearing a glass mask, which is never really explained why. Because I don't know how he breathes in that thing.
Okay, let's discuss these gangs of people and the thing that the film is attempting to communicate but failing repeatedly to get across to any audience attempting to understand this film. From what I can discern from little breadcrumbs along the way in this movie, what we're supposed to think is that there are people walking around in the world who are descendants of people from Atlantis. Some of them know it and some of them don't. But as soon as Atlantis surfaces, well then, they all become aware of their ancestry and become these violent gangs. Understand. I am piecing this together for multiple viewings of this damn film.
See, that's not how that's not how I imagined it, actually. So that's interesting.
Well, your vision of it may be just as valid. Yeah. What are you thinking?
Well, I just assumed that in the remnants of Atlantis that have been at the bottom of the ocean, they've had a fully functioning automobile and motorcycle manufacturing industry, and like the impression I got was that they'd just ridden straight off the island on these things, which didn't make any sense at all.
Sense.
So your idea makes a bit more sense, I mean,
but
only
still
just.
Doesn't make much sense because Crystal Skull guy has to have been aware of his ancestry,
yeah.
Or how would he have the crystal skull?
Yeah, because he's got it in a drawer in his desk or something, and he puts it on. And then,
yeah, he pulls it out and puts it on like it's time to rock and roll now,
yeah,
buddy.
Like,
you know?
Suddenly he's got this gang of post-apocalypse people. And so, yes, I mean, that's really where we would... That's why this film, I think, gets included in the post-apocalypse genre, because of the look of these guys. They are straight out of Mad Max. They're very colourful. And this is where... This is the, you know, that Filipino stunt school that Deodato had met. This is where they come into their own. And we just get loads of action sequences and gunfights and chases and explosions and all kinds of exciting stuff. So they, once they're, yeah, so I'm trying to remember now, and even the plot description in here isn't that helpful. They go and they land on this island where they discover all the inhabitants have been slaughtered by this gang who've either just suddenly put all the makeup on or they've just come up from the bubble. We're not sure which. And Kathy gets, because Kathy has this stone. Oh yeah, that was right. I forgot to mention. So the reason she was brought to the oil rig in the first place is because they found an artifact at the bottom of the ocean that she can translate. And she says it's basically like the Rosetta Stone for Atlantis. And
which, you know, sure,
yeah.
We'll go with that.
So she can translate the Atlantean language. And so somehow they know this. I don't know how the Mad Max people know this, but they kidnap her so that they can take her back to their underground base, that because she might be able to unlock the key, the knowledge that's been long forgotten by the current inhabitants. But if she can unlock it, it will restore Atlantis to its former glory. Is that about...
Okay, this is already more coherent than the film itself.
Oh, dear. So, yeah, so she's kidnapped, and Mike is already a little bit in love with her, despite the fact that she could be his daughter. And
the age range would work out very well.
So they manage to get hold of a helicopter, and off they go. There's a quite an exciting chase where they're all in an old bus, and there's a helicopter. So, yeah, this is also confusing. So the Atlanteans have a helicopter, and they're chasing them in the bus.
It's best not to think about it. It's really...
There's some good stunts. They're jumping from the helicopter to the bus and all of that sort of stuff. And later on, Christopher Connolly has to jump from the top of a vehicle onto a different helicopter. And Ruggero Deodato said that he was doing all that stuff himself, which is quite impressive because...
Yeah.
Helicopters are terrifying. Like, every time I read a book about Italian genre cinema, there'll be something involving a horrific helicopter crash.
Oh, I know.
So,
yeah.
Every time I see a helicopter turn up in one of these films, I kind of clench. I'm just worried that something bad could happen.
I just have to say that I think that at this point, whenever they finally got around to perfecting drone technology for different kinds of aerial shots, we probably saved the lives of God knows how many cameramen and helicopter pilots, because you no longer have to do that to get those kinds of images on screen.
So they're on this one island that's a kind of human island, but now they've got to get to the Atlantis island in the dome. So they fly off in another helicopter that they found. It's quite handy that they've got Bill, the helicopter pilot, with them. And this is... So they fly over this island. It's obviously one of these just beautiful, verdant islands that the Philippines has so many of. But this is why I was confused, because I was looking at that island thinking, well, where did they get all the motorbikes? Like, how...
Or the cool 50s car that is tricked out like crazy.
Like, where have they been? If that is all that's left of Atlantis. So your theory makes more sense. If somehow the people have just been gradually building up their army ready to fight back. I don't really know. It doesn't make sense. Because
I guess.
Because for a long time, the nuclear submarine thing is kind of forgotten about. And I wondered what had happened about that. But then we get an explanation eventually from Professor Saunders, George Hilton, that the nuclear sub being risen to the surface somehow caused some kind of radiation leak or something that is what triggered the rise of Atlantis. So that's why Atlantis has decided to come back now. Is that right?
Which, yeah, it's apparently the nearness of the radio, you know, atomic powered sub and the nuclear missiles thereupon that has caused Atlantis to rise.
So it's
all by chance.
Instead of bringing mutant fish, it's brought guys with mohawks. And
which, you know. Yeah. That's a movie that you could make.
So
they kind of play with the idea of making that movie.
Yep. Oh, and I forgot to mention they met another human, who is a German called Klaus, played by Stefano Mingardo, who I really recognized. I'm sure I've seen him. Has he been in all of Margariti's German co-productions? Because he looked really familiar to me. I'm just looking him up now. This is live IMDb surfing. I know this is what podcast audiences love.
Oh, it's the best. It's exactly what you came here for.
But he didn't. He's been in Blast Fighter. Well, I don't know what I recognize him from then, because he's only in four films, apparently.
Well, but I would recognize him from Blast Fighter, that's for sure.
But so he's quite a fun character. So he comes along just to help them, because why not? And he's quite handy with a gun. So they're all running around on this lovely island, shooting all these guys. And there's loads of stunts and people falling from really high, which is quite good.
Yeah, now I have to say, as much as I'm running this film down, and believe me, I know I am definitely running this film down, some of the stunt work and some of the action sequences are a lot of fun.
Yeah.
They don't make a lick of sense.
Nope.
There is no coherency to be found, but it moves. I'll give it that.
Yeah, it's like Deodato went to these writers and said, okay, I want you to write me a script that will make the audience keep talking about this film on the way home. And they sort of they misunderstood what he meant. And I thought, well,
he didn't specify why they
exactly
were talking about the film. Yes.
Oh dear. Okay. So yeah. So this is where we get to the sort of, it's almost like a sort of Vietnam type sequence where they're fighting on the beach. Meanwhile, somehow the nuclear sub has washed up on the beach of Atlantis.
Don't ask too many questions.
Or maybe it got stuck on the. Maybe they came up under the sub and it just kind of got stuck on it. But
sure,
the sub is there. So George Hilton's going to go and get one of the nuclear missiles to blow up Atlantis. Is that what he's going to do?
That seems to be the idea.
Yeah.
Not much seems to come of it, but
no, just like nothing comes from Wash changing his name to Muhammad and then just ignoring it for most of the movie.
Well, here's the thing. You were speaking earlier about the impression that you got that they essentially had a series of ideas for set pieces, for action sequences, and the whole idea was we got to find a way to string all this crap together. And never is it more evident, well, it's evident throughout the film, but never is it more evident than the sequence of events that allows them to string up a wire across a road to decapitate one of the motorcycle riding interceptor guys, where it's just like, you know, they just wanted to film this scene. Oh, let's be clear.
And there's another bit where one of the interceptors gets smacked with one of those spiked bamboo traps that you've seen in all the Vietnam movies. And then
we
cut to Mike Ross and he explains to Klaus the cleverness of building this thing. But I was looking at it thinking, that would have taken hours.
Hours, yes.
He's had to cut down all the bamboo. I didn't even see any bamboo growing in that forest either. So he's had to source the bamboo. He's had to cut each piece to size. He's had to find the twine to whatever he's used
to tie it all
together. I mean, that was just hilarious.
So,
but this is why we love these films, right?
It's certainly what affection I have for this film does actually grow from the fact that it is completely insane.
Yeah.
Nothing makes sense. Everything is strung together in a haphazard fashion. Mm-hmm. There's the only motivation is to keep moving. The movie is chock full of completely ridiculous and stupid things. I mean, the point at which they're essentially barricaded inside a bar, they're looking around for things to defend themselves, and in an amazing coincidence, guess what they find? All kinds of shotguns and boxes of shells and booze that they can turn into Molotov cocktails. So.
Yeah, I meant to introduce this film as Assault on Atlantis 13. Because that whole... that's basically what we
that's
get.
That's not bad, yeah.
We get that for about 20 minutes.
Yep, yeah, it's true. It's true. And the thing is, at first... it felt a little bit like the siege portion of Fulci's Zombie, just a little, and then everything cranks up, and you're like, no, it's something different. And Assault on Precinct 13 is a good call. Yeah, mm-hmm. you're about right. Yeah,
yeah. So I don't want to give the ending away because this is definitely worth watching, and it's available on a lovely Blu-ray, so you've got no excuse. Available in France as well from Pulse Video.
You've got no excuse. I love the fact that you say they've got no excuse. Yeah. If they're listening to us, they have every excuse in the world.
So I don't want to give the anyway, but yeah, they eventually have to find their way into the inner sanctum of the Atlantis, and that's where it starts to get really sci-fi.
And yeah, I know. And this is kind of fascinating because it's like Raiders of the Lost Ark crossed with some kind of science fiction weirdness. Mm-hmm. It's bizarre.
It reminded me a little bit of The Visitor for some reason. You know, like the sort of...
Yeah, I could see that.
Space Jesus stuff. It also reminds me of Zardos. But I don't know if these are the kind of comparisons they'd want me to be making.
Probably not. Especially not John Borman. I mean, at least there was some thought behind the screenplay for Zardoz, and I'm really sure that there was very little thought behind the script for this thing.
But Deodato, he talked about this with great fondness. Like, he had a great time making it, even though he knows it doesn't make any sense. And he also said, he said in the interview how he doesn't like it when people say it's a science fiction film because he hates science fiction, apparently, which is a bit harsh.
Yeah.
But I mean,
some people don't like certain genres, and that's okay.
But he made one anyway, whether he likes it or not. So I don't think there's any getting away from that, really.
And it does bring up the idea that if you dislike a genre, you know, is it even possible for you to make a decent entry in that genre? I mean, if you're not going to take the genre either at face value or remotely seriously, does it behoove you to even try? Because if you already dislike it, you're not exactly invested in trying to contribute to it,
But it obviously worked for him because it broke the curse, and then he carried on making films. He went, like you said, he made Cut and Run after this.
Yeah.
But I looked it up, and from what I can tell, it did not get a release in cinemas in America or the UK, as far as I can tell, but it did get released on VHS. So... I think it was released as The Atlantis Interceptors in America, and here, or was that? No, I think it was Raiders of Atlantis in America and Atlantis Interceptors in the UK. So this was a straight to VHS release for us, but I think it was in cinemas in Italy, as far as I can tell.
Okay.
So I couldn't find any reviews. I was trying to find some contemporary reviews and see what people thought of this when it came out, but I guess because it was on VHS, it was kind of ignored by the press, but it's their loss, is what I say.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, and we've talked about this already in doing this series of films. I mean, this being kind of grouped in with the various post-apocalyptic films, it kind of fits and it kind of doesn't. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, so many of them are released in such a short period of time that it would have been almost impossible for any man or woman at all who was tasked with the idea of having to review cinema during that period of the 80s to not eventually just throw up their hands and go, okay, look, man, enough. This has got to stop. And the thing is, I mean, it did burn itself out very, very quick.
Yeah.
But imagine being in the thick of it and having to pay attention to this stuff because it's your damn job. the amount of frustration and kind of head hung low, rubbing of the eyes that you would go through, just going, oh God, do I need to how much intoxication is necessary for me to make it through this one? It's just, there has to have been a point where far too many people felt that this, there needed to be an intervention, mm-hmm. perhaps some outside force, yeah. perhaps the government needs to pass a law. They need to stop making these things.
And I think, if I'd have watched this in the mid-80s on VHS, I don't think I'd have worried too much about the plot. I'd have just enjoyed all the action. Wouldn't have cared if I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand what was going on in most of the films I was watching at that age, so we would have just enjoyed all the shooting and the bikes and all that stuff.
Well, these movies were primarily aimed at a younger audience, and by younger audience, I'm saying, essentially a teenage yeah. audience to a degree.
Sure.
So they're the ones that are being aimed at.
Yeah, yeah, and it's good fun. Oh, and I almost forgot, the score is by Oliver Onions. Again, aka the De Angelis Brothers, which is a perfect excuse for me to play this again.
What are you doing to us?
Yeah, there you go. They will always have a place in my heart for that tune.
Your childhood, you British people are very, very, very strange. Of course, what can I say other than the fact, I mean, in comparison, I have on an endless loop in my head both the theme song and all of the incidental music from Gilligan's Island. Oh, so we're all trapped in our own particular hells, I guess.
Now, I was going to mention, I've recently, well, I say recently, it's taken me ages, but I've started reading the classic counterculture novel, The Illuminatus Trilogy, which is very long. I'm about halfway through, and it's just, it's basically just rammed full of conspiracy theories. But the one I've just been reading about is that basically the Illuminati started on Atlantis. So it's quite interesting to compare that with this one. There was no mention of motorbikes or tricked out hot rods, but according to that theory, this is the home of the origins of the Illuminati. So maybe that's who it was that was controlling all of the bikers. Did they have psychic powers?
Oh wow, there's a theory that doesn't hold up under any scrutiny at all.
Okay, well, I think we should probably just drop any further speculation.
Well, here's a question I have for you before we run away from this movie. Mm-hmm. I have a question. I know that you have a particular affection for Ruggero Deodato, and just as in a general way, I was just curious about this, and I wanted to ask you if what really would you consider to be your favorite of his directorial efforts, because the stuff that he made that is most famous is pretty dark and harsh stuff,
mm-hmm.
and so my curiosity for you is like, which ones do you really, really enjoy? Which ones do you think are of as your favorites that he produced?
Well, I mean, his best film is Cannibal Holocaust, and Cannibal Holocaust is a masterpiece in my opinion, and but it's not necessarily the film I would stick on for fun.
Definitely not.
So I mean, it's pretty obvious, but I would have to say Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man, which is what I'm going to put on my tombstone. Lived like a cop, died like a man, I think is quite a good epitaph. So
I cannot wait for you to communicate this to your family. This is what I want on my tombstone.
I think that's definitely up there, and I know when I spoke to him about it, he said that was his favorite film of his. But
really? Oh, okay. Yeah.
But he's got other films. I mean, there's quite a few of his movies I haven't seen, so I've not been a completist yet with him. But I mean, they've all got something going for them. Even the silly ones like Phantom of Death.
Phantom of Death has just gotten. They're about to release that over here in the States on Blu-ray.
Cauldron just announced that one, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. Those Cannibal Holocaust is like the film that would win the Oscar. And Live Like a Cop.
Oh no.
Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man is the kind of comfort film that I would just stick on to impress people. I mean, okay, how about you? Okay. Do you have any favorites?
I have a few favorites, and I have a few films that remain gaps in my viewing that I'm a little disappointed by. First of all, I will say that I have to eventually track down a copy of one of his 1960s films, Gungala the Black Panther Girl, because I must see it for various and sundry reasons, none of which are really worth discussing in public.
I mean, maybe we should do a Panther Girl mini season.
Honestly, if you wanted to find a reason to do Italian Jungle Girl films, I can think of a good solid five of them that would be worth talking about. All right. That would be a lot of fun. But do you want to talk about a niche, I should say, that very few people are going to be following us down into? Let's just say I know that I'm weird to be fascinated by these things, especially considering, you know, what was possible and what was not possible. But yes, I think I will eventually one day see Deodato's example.
I think exploring a niche within what is already a niche is basically the MO of this podcast. So,
you know, you may be right. Maybe we do need to do like a mini season of Jungle Girl films. Yep. That's not a bad idea. Oh, but at any rate, like I say, although I haven't seen that one yet, I still need to track down a copy of that. I think Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man is astonishing. I think it's just an incredible film. Cannibal Holocaust, I'm utterly impressed by and also appalled by. Mm-hmm. We discussed that at length over on the Bloody Pit several years ago. I have a certain fascination for his nastier things like House on the Edge of the Park and Cut and Run. And I have to say, there's a special weird little place in my heart for his backwoods body count film called Body Count from 1986.
Oh, yeah.
I have a lot of time for that. Mm. I keep hoping that there will be a decent release of that to come out eventually. Mm. I don't know if there's a rights problem or if there's a problem getting your hands on, people getting their hands on decent, decent elements. But I mean, I'm utterly fascinated by it. I mean, once again, it has Ivan Razumov as Charles Napier. It has Mimsy Farmer and David Hess. It's John Steiner, it's a film that. Yeah. Yeah, it really is well worth seeing, and it is quite entertaining. And no one was fooling anybody with the English title Body Count. Very let's put it that way.
Very nice. Yes, I'm sure we will definitely come back to Deodato again in some form or other, because he touched on so many different genres during his career.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this will not be the last time. So next episode, we are going to be talking about a film called Exterminators of the Year 3000, which is going to be another first-time watch for me, so I'm looking forward to that.
I think I've seen that one, but it was a very long time ago.
Oh, I forgot to mention, before we go, I saw Dario Argento last week.
That's right. I saw the photos you posted.
Yeah, I was going to tell you about it. So there's a season right now at the BFI. The whole month of May, they're showing about, I think it's 17 different restorations that have recently been done by Bologna, by the Cineteca. And so, yeah, but he had an accident about a month or so ago. I think he broke his leg. He fell at home. So he did not look in a good way. And he had a stick when he came out. I think he was probably a little bit medicated. He didn't want to cancel it, so he came, but he didn't look that great, poor guy. And everything was being translated, So he was been asked the questions. The interviewer was Prano Bailey Bond, the director that had sent her. And the so she'd ask him the question in English. Somebody would translate it for him. He would answer it in Italian. She would translate it back to English. Meanwhile, all the people in the audience that spoke Italian were laughing before we were, because they'd heard his, they understood what he'd said. I was just, I was getting about every fifth word, so it wasn't really working for me. But it was really good. So they spoke for about an hour, and I was really hoping that they would open it out to the audience, but I think he was basically getting tired. So they ended it after an hour, and then he was supposed to be introducing Suspiria. So I was going to stay and watch Suspiria, but then I went to see, just like hang around by the green room, which is just outside the main screen of the BFI, to see what was going on. And I saw him come out and wave to people and then leave. And they said he was going back to the hotel. He wasn't going to do the introduction because he was too tired. So that was disappointing. So I didn't stay in the end. I had a long way to get home that night. So I decided to cash in my ticket. There was a queue of people trying to get cancelled tickets. So I let one of them have it. But apparently the next day he did some introductions for Tenebrae and Inferno, and you know, so he was, he stuck around for the weekend and did a few more intros, but the full hour event was really good. I'm glad I was there. It was really interesting. I mean, he didn't necessarily tell us any stories we hadn't heard before particularly, but it was just great to be in the room with him and to get the opportunity to applaud him. There was a big standing ovation at the end. And this might be the last time something like this happens. You know, I don't want to be morbid, but
yeah,
he's old and frail now, and probably isn't going to want to travel much more after this, I wouldn't think. So
I wouldn't either.
I wouldn't be at all surprised if he doesn't come back to the UK. So really glad I got to go. It's pretty cool. And also, I managed to get to him via staff that I know at the BFI. I got him a copy of my book on Norman J. Warren, because I thought Norman would like that. Norman was a big fan of Dario, and they did know each other a little bit, and he was a big influence on Norman's films, especially Terror, which is basically a ripoff of Suspiria.
Pretty much, exactly.
So I managed to get a copy of the book to him. I didn't get to meet him, but at least hopefully he's taken it home. So that was good. So that was last weekend for me. So I nearly forgot to tell you about it. There we go.
Well, I'm glad you remembered, because you're right. I mean, we are approaching that time when we're going to eventually have to say goodbye to Mr. Argento, and that will be a sad day. I mean, we've in recent days, you know, we're getting to the point where there's not a month that goes by where we don't lose luminary who I kind of grew up idolizing or being impressed by or being entertained by.
It was just Helmut Berger yesterday, I think, passed away.
Exactly. Helmut Berger and Jim Brown, too.
Oh, yes. Yep.
And it's very easy, unfortunately, to remember these as they happen, because they just seem to come so quickly. And these are people who, you know, had a massive, massive impact on their respective, their careers they loom large over what they did. Yeah. And it's one of those things where you're appalled that they're passing, but at the same time, these people, Jim Brown was in his 80s. I mean, you forget that he's not still that tough guy actor or that tough guy football player. And with Helmut Berger, you still just picture him as that guy that you last saw on screen, you know?
Well, and from the opposite perspective, there was a big furore kicking off yesterday, because they've just screened another new cut of Caligula, which was screening at the Cannes Festival yesterday. And Tinto Brass has come out and said he's going to sue them. And I just read that and I was like, wait,
why?
Tinto Brass is still alive.
Well, okay, there's that too.
So that was that was my response. I was like, what? And if he's still, because he's complained that they didn't get him, that he wasn't involved. They've edited it without him, so therefore it's not his film, because he wasn't involved in the editing. As far as he's concerned, the filmmaking is the editing. And it surprises me that they would go to all the trouble to do a new cut of Caligula and not involve him at all. But maybe, like me, maybe they read that and they're like, wait, he's still alive? And they just...
they were unaware. It's like, holy crap, he is?
Yeah, they just forgot to check.
Well, I mean, the thing is, there have been two or three different
edits of Caligula mm-hmm. over the years. I mean, it's the fact that there's a new one isn't exactly a shock.
But this is interesting because apparently they've used all entirely new shots. They claim
really?
They claim that nothing is in there that was in the original film. So they've used other takes, wow. different takes, and created basically
that's
a new film.
Crazy.
Yeah, they've created a new film out of all the footage and left everything that was in the original film out, which I don't know how that's going to work. But it's getting good reviews, but Tinto Brass, who's 90, is quite annoyed.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Yeah, so,
I'm a little... Now, I have to admit, now with that knowledge, I'm a little more interested in seeing this new cut.
Intriguing.
That's very interesting.
Anyway, we've gone way off topic, but...
Yes, we have. Sorry, people. Sorry.
Thanks, everybody, for being with us again. Please do get in touch with us. We love hearing from you. I've been getting some nice comments on Twitter lately, so do get in touch with us there. You can also email us. You can buy us a virtual coffee. We're on Instagram as well, and or you can just stop either of us in the street and give us the special handshake.
Yes, the special fingernail tickle,
the special handshake that only people from Atlantis know. So that's another good way to contact us.
Any crystal skulls that you might want, or crystal masks that you might want to send our way, are welcome.
Yep. So thanks, everybody, and we'll be back relatively soon. Rod and I do have a couple of exciting top secret commentary track projects on the go at the moment, which may slightly delay us getting to the next episode, but it'll be worth it, I assure you.
Yes.
And with that,
very exciting stuff.
With that said, we'll say bye for now, and we'll be back soon-ish. Bye.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.